You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Solidarity Breakfast and you're here with Annie and Anila and Tabea. Hello, you guys. How are you?
Good morning.
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
I realised that last week we actually missed the weather update.
I think the week before people are starved of them.
Well, all you have to do is go outside and find that it's balmy all the time. I mean, I came back from Glasgow and I thought, oh my God, it's so hot and it's light till 9 o'clock. What is this world coming to?
And anyone with curly hair, I think, deserves some recognition right now because the amount of humidity is not enjoyable.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. If you're going to inspect your navel, worrying about the weather at the moment.
And your hair.
And your hair. That means that you're diverting your attention from the general indescribable carry-on that's going on at the moment. What have you got for us this morning?
I've been following what's been going on in Cuba, and things have escalated since there was the US-imposed oil blockade on the island in January, which has caused all sorts of difficulties for people on the island. But late on Wednesday, the situation escalated when 10 exiled Cuban men aboard a US-registered boat opened fire on Cuban border guards. In the shootout, 4 of the men on board were killed and 6 injured. The Guardian has reported that one of the men who died, Michelle Ortega Casanova, had spoken of wanting to liberate the island. Wilfredo Beira, who's the head of the Cuban Republican Party in Tampa, Florida, which is where the boat was registered, has said that his goal, quote, was to go and fight against a criminal and murderous narco-tyrannical government to see if that would spark the people to rise up. Cuban authorities have said that the survivors were all Cuban residents in the US who now stand accused of intending to, quote, carry out an infiltration for the purposes of terrorism.
Well, yes. I don't know if they've got a leg to stand on, really, do they?
No.
Yeah, we'll see how America replies.
Well, they've denied any involvement, but I think based on Marco Rubio's track record and past statements about Cuba, I'm not sure that they would view it as a great loss that this has happened.
I mean, the man literally wrote in his memoirs that he would liberate Cuba and one day be its president.
But I think
he's 40.
It's really important to link it to general kind of escalations of violence in the region, obviously, especially following Maduro's kidnapping at the end of last year. So a situation that seems to be deteriorating and definitely needs to be kept an eye on.
Yeah, well, we see what's happened in Mexico as well with the killing of a cartel boss. It's plunged the country into some pretty dire instability, and it wonders whether that was a American-influenced attack at all, or if America had any part to play in that at all. Perhaps they didn't. Well, certainly time will tell.
Well, you know, if you want to look at the use of media and to create narratives, I guess we can come a little bit closer to home. Green Left Weekly has a report by Sue Ball about the recent Jeffrey Watson report on Queensland inquiry into the CFMEU and misconduct in the construction industry. The name of that inquiry is it's so much like when did you stop beating your wife? It's incredible. But anyway, Sue Ball, she writes in Green Left, I am a retired Construction Forestry Maritime Employees Union, CFMEU member, and a former union health and safety trainer for nearly 20 years. And I am horrified that Jeffrey Watson's February the 11th report to the ongoing Queensland Commission is being taken seriously. The allegations sound bad, but hard evidence of the union's criminality is missing in his rotting from the top, the CFMEU in Victoria during the Setka era. It is also clear that what originally began as a union investigation into the CFMEU in Melbourne in July 2024 has now been turned into a propaganda piece for an inquiry in another state. The union's alleged criminality is assumed to be a fact, but is based on very few convictions or even arrests, and rather on hearsay and guilt by association. For instance, mainstream media obsession with allegedly $15 billion worth of corrupt payments connected to the CFMEU is not included in the report, yet continues to be front page news. No one can substantiate what that figure represents, nor whose pockets it supposedly ended up in. In fact, it was quite interesting. There was a report in the same rags around a an event at skullduggery that was at one of the tunnel construction sites that were actually not covered by the CFMEU but covered by the AWU, and it was a scandal which has been under review, which is about a supervisor pressuring female workers for sex and also selling job rights for $5,000, right? So it's under review. But in the paper, it was talking about it, and then it abandoned the data and went straight on to five paragraphs of talking about how bad the CFMEU are, even though the CFMEU don't cover those workers, and it had nothing to do with them. So
very subtle.
Very subtle indeed.
Yeah, absolutely crazy, that stuff, especially in the report that it For the Queensland CFMEU, it recommended and actually carried out the immediate cessation of the youth crew activities up there, which were accused of being
what youthful
criminal activity and like harassing people, and it was all like an unnamed source said that they were harassed and all this stuff. The report's actually pretty terrible.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, really, basically, it's not only news by gossip, but it's news by innuendo. It's pretty freaky. There was some pretty good news coming out of Tasmania to a certain degree. There's been a suspension of salmon farming antibiotic use, which is an interesting development. Mm-hmm. The announcement came off the back of a recent reporting that the antibiotic had contaminated wild fish such as abalone and rock lobster as far as 10 kilometres from the nearest industrial fish pen. The antibiotic is fluorphenicol, and they were using it in Tasmania's factory fish farms. Of course, the sea doesn't have fences. just like the air doesn't maintain a hold around asbestos or nuclear fallout or any of those kind of things. Doesn't matter what you think, you know. Bob Brown Foundation is calling for a complete ban on the dumping of antibiotics en masse by the fish farm corporations and for the factory fish farms to be required to fallow and destock fish farms in times of disease outbreak. It's all pretty grim, really.
Well, we live in a fishbowl, you know. Eventually it comes round.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I think the salmon farming is a really great little case study of how politics in Australia works, because the seat that would basically have the oversight to be able to make changes to the governance of the industry is held by Labor, and a majority of the people in the area are employed by the salmon industry. So it would be political suicide for them to actively intervene and regulate the industry more effectively. And I think it's a really great example of how, you know, science can... There can be a consensus scientifically and morally, but if it's politically inconvenient, it becomes almost an impossibility to actually do something about a problem.
And I think you're fine. Yeah, and also they inflate this concept of how many people are actually working in these industries. I mean, you feel for the people who do work there and get a living out of it. But it takes me back to when I used to live in East Gippsland. There was a public meeting down there of timber workers in one of the small towns as the government was trying to move them towards, taking up other skills in other industries. In this public meeting, they were told quite clearly that they'd have 20 more years of forestry and that there would be no more forests. And they voted to continue to knock down the forest. So your argument's true, but for a handful of people having work and denuding our environment is probably a step too far.
Definitely, and not to mention, I think they've done research. I can't cite the research, so maybe I shouldn't be saying this on air. But they've done research into the kind of most effective ways of transitioning communities away from industries that have, you know, detrimental impacts for whatever reason. And they tend to find that ripping off the band-aid and having quick transitions and reskilling people as quickly as possible is better for communities than dragging these processes out for a really long time to try and hold
on to. And one of the problems is that people want well-paid, good work, and we're talking, I suppose, traditionally blue-collar work. But when you go, because of the nasty rot that is at the heart of capitalism, even when you do the transfer to, say, creating wind farms, you'll find that the corporations that run them don't want to pay people properly, don't want to give them safe environments, and they are subsidised by government. So really that is the battleground. Where workers want good work and safe work, and it's the job of our community to make sure that that is really the priority.
Well said, Annie. But moving back to your previous point about, I think you said gossip as news.
Yeah, gossip as news.
I've got some actual gossip as news that I think we need to talk about.
Dissect.
Yeah. So Politico has reported on Wednesday that senior advisors to President Trump would prefer if Israel attacks Iran to launch a war against the Islamic Republic rather than having the US lead the opening airstrikes. Quote, there's thinking in and around the administration that the politics are a lot better if Israelis go first and alone and the Iranians retaliate against us and give us more reason to take action, a person familiar with the discussions within the administration told Politico. Despite the negotiations with Iran, the Politico report said that the belief among senior officials is that we are going to bomb them, quote unquote, according to one of the sources, who also acknowledged the risk of major US casualties. So,
yeah, well, there's two things about the Americans. They never fight a fair fight, and two, they speak with forked tongue. It always the same, always the same. Closer, let's go back here to Australia. Did you notice the newly appointed Northern Territory Administrator, the Honourable David Connolly, was sworn in as the 24th Administrator of the Northern Territory just the other day? They were sworn in by the Governor-General, despite negative responses from Indigenous MPs and community. Connolly.
I think you're saying it right. He's definitely a representative of the colony.
Yeah. Formerly the head of This is what I can't get over. Formerly the head of the Cattlemen's Association has been outed for historic racist and sexist posts on social media during his tenure as an MP, not just as an ordinary bod, but just as a representative, using the police as a political tool once again outside the Northern Territory Parliament, was proclaimed a designated area during the swearing-in so that when demonstrators voiced their anger, police were able to legally stymie dissent and proceeded to arrest an Aboriginal elder for being on his own land. Boom, boom.
Shocking.
Yeah, we'll follow up the NT stuff because there's a lot of moving parts happening now, especially with Impex, the gas giant, continuing to unfurl its plans with the Beetaloo Basin and a lot of the fracking up there, as we've seen the Texas giant in Western Australia get approved by the EPA for fracking in the Kimberleys.
Isn't that just disgraceful? I mean, in what universe do you frack the Kimberleys? I mean, for God's sake, get a grip, guys. And not even, I mean, it's a moribund technology. It's a poison and it's in a country that hangs on by the bare fingernails when it comes to water. I mean, in what universe does a practical group of people allow a Texan, an American company, corporation, to come here and to hollow out one of the most beautiful parts of Australia?
Well, as a part two of what Anila was saying as well about what Australian politics looks like, it looks like foreign interest groups lobbying hard the government and getting
Anything that they want,
that they'd like in with the Tasmanian industries.
It's a pay-to-play system.
yeah.
Three multinationals with the fracking. It's five multinationals.
And it's not to mention the strip mining of jarrah trees down the bottom of Western Australia for rare earth minerals, which next week we'll have an excerpt about the mining in Congo and the politics around rare earth mineral mining, because that is actually the reason for why Trump is interested in Greenland, because they thought that there was going to be a little problem getting stuff out of the Congo. So if you think that, you know, it's a bit like throwing a pebble into the pond, you know, really, if you want to look at how the world's going in terms of climate action, climate disaster, go to the insurance companies and what they're saying. And if you want to know what's happening in terms of expressions of pure power, just go to what the corporations, the mining companies, are trying to do. Which leads to this quite interesting thing about the MMG. The MMG is a mining company down the Bob Brown Foundation has been fighting against them being able to create a tailings dam in the Tarkine, effectively. And they've just recently it's been disallowed. They're not allowed to do it at Kimmy's Creek, and they're going to look for another site. But they don't actually need to do the tailings dam there. They have other options which are more sustainable, which is fascinating. It's a Chinese company, and it's owned by the Chinese, majority owned by the Chinese government. So it's another one, another wing. Mm. And interestingly, when I was looking them up, they describe themselves as all about sustainability. It's sort of like a massive greenwashing campaign, and the areas that they mine are in rare earth minerals in Congo and Botswana, and there's a major battle going on in Botswana right at this moment by indigenous people to defend their lands against these mining giants. Now, we don't really need to dwell really on nationalities. Nation states are irrelevant when it comes to making large amounts of money by corporations. Australia is an active part in trying to undermine indigenous people's hold on their lands in South America, for example. None of them are wearing the white hat, I'm telling you. None of them are wearing the white hat.
I do think maybe one difference worth pointing out is between nation states is that depending on which country you're from and how much you're a beneficiary of
the lucre.
But also depending on, you know, the color of your skin, whether or not your ancestors were doing the colonizing or being colonized.
Yeah, depends on where you're standing, you reckon.
Well, I think it means that you are viewed as more or less disposable and more or less as a resource to be used.
Yeah.
So I think it's your point feels very pertinent that there seems to be across borders this kind of like might is right approach to the wealthiest amongst us.
Yeah.
Pillaging.
But they're not our friends.
Also, I think a good way of thinking about it is kind of pillaging what is our most basic kind of common wealth, our shared wealth and environments and culture. But the risks for the people in those communities do change depending on which country you're in and
that's true.
Your proximity to powerful countries.
No, that's exactly right. I want to finish off our headlines with an interesting little piece that came out of the Yarra Ratepayers. This is very local. When Jeff Kennett, and this is an opinion piece, when Jeff Kennett and Stephen Jolly agree council system is broken and being used as a tool of the state government, you know something is seriously wrong. When the state government uses councils to do its dirty work, the system is broken. Councils shouldn't be treated as cost centres and quiet tax collectors for a cash-strapped state, especially through backdoor hikes like the massive increased fire services levy. As I said, this is from the Yarra ratepayers. Jolly, who's the mayor of Yarra, told The Age that Yarra has identified close to $10.5 million a year in cost shifting, in inverted commas, essential services like libraries and school crossings, once co-funded by state and local government, but now largely bankrolled by ratepayers. After a decade of state-mandated rate capping, Jolly said the business model is untenable. Amalgamation is not my number one. This is not what I want, he said. I want the government to cough up the money, but we can't just keep patching things up. He added that as a trade unionist, he would rather see his own council merge than be forced to become the Maggie Thatcher of Victoria and sack staff.
And it's such a shame because local government can be such a powerful mechanism of creating genuine kind of change and support for communities. But I think that how ineffective they've become.
But so sneaky of the state government.
Yeah, very sneaky. But I think it's being reflected in community members' views of their local governments. Like I think the ABC...
Well, of course, it's up close and personal.
Yeah, the ABC released some figures this week, I think, about people's level of dissatisfaction with local governments, and most or a majority of people viewed local government as essentially expendable. And I think the other part of the
picture... I don't think they're really understanding how the process works.
No, but I think the other part of the picture is also things like property developers having such a big finger in the pie on local governments, councils and things like that. So I think it's so painful to watch because local governments are such an important part of the picture, but they've kind of been completely... usurped by the people in power.
Is it pessimistic of me to say that almost all of the politics is about developers and mining?
I don't think that's cynical.
Moving right along.
I think that's a reasonable opinion.
Well, community.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Hi, we're from Braver College, and you're listening to Free CR Community Radio
on 8:55 a.m.
You certainly are, and you're with Eddie and Nilla and Tabea on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're going to go to a recording from the 22nd of February Sydney rally from Vivian Langford from the Climate Action Show. She's are on Monday at 5 p.m. on 3CR. They also network because they're on Skid Row as well, I believe. So look it up and get your app because you'll be able to tune in any old time. This time it's a speech by Mark Gillespie, and as he says, he's a 78er, a gay rights activist who experienced police violation in 1978, defending their rights and to victory. Now there's this multiverse of Mardi Gras. Apparently nobody was against gay people in Sydney. tell it to the people who experienced the battens. And he makes some very interesting correlations between what happened then and what happened in Sydney not too long ago.
Mark Gillespie, now, we talked a bunch about police brutality, and we've been talking about how this is some of the worst police brutality we've seen for decades. Perhaps the last clearest example of this kind of police brutality was, of course, the first Mardi Gras march that carried out in 1978 when the police attacked our rights. And Chris Minns is trying to take us back to a legal time before 1978 when we didn't have the right to march and the cops did this kind of thing. Mark Gillespie was there. He was one of the original 78ers, paving the way in the fight for LGBT rights in this country, and he's been a staunch activist in support of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. And he's going to talk today about those links as well. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Josh. Your words are most appreciated. And I acknowledge the previous speakers. My brother, who spoke first from Palestine, whose humanity almost brought me to tears. Good afternoon to all of you. It's good that you are here. I would like to acknowledge that we gather on Gadigal land, land that was never ceded. And what I would like to say here is that I support the continued just struggle for sovereignty over this land for Aboriginal people. For nearly 2.5 years now, we have gathered almost every Sunday here at this beautiful spot in the northern part of Hyde Park. We came together because we are witnessing events that humanity has repeatedly vowed must never happen again. After the Holocaust, the world said never again. After Cambodia, the world said never again. After Rwanda, the world said never again. Each time, humanity recognized that when innocent people are being slaughtered, the world not only has the right but the responsibility to speak, to act, and to refuse silence. Australia has understood this in the past. As a middle power, we invested in diplomacy and conflict resolution. We helped to bring an end to Pol Pot's regime. We believed that human life mattered wherever it was lived. Yet now we are here in 2026, in a world that has become more dangerous, a world where violence is normalized, populations are desensitized, and moral responsibility is increasingly abandoned. I want to briefly explain who is speaking to you today and why. I am a teacher and a social anthropologist. I lived and worked for many years in Africa and the Middle East. I'm now retired from the University of Sydney. I am a foundation member of a grassroots community organization, the City of Sydney for Palestine. As Josh said, I am also a 78er, and I must say that does not mean that I'm 78 years old. I'm not quite there yet, but getting close. That 78th generation that I belong to, back in June of 1978, were brutalized by the New South Wales Police in a way that I saw again and experienced and witnessed again on February the 9th, that Monday, a couple of Mondays ago, by the same New South Wales Police. At this point, I want to just speak briefly in Arabic, perhaps particularly to Palestinian Muslims and Christians who are here with us today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Ahlan wa sahlan. Ramadan Kareem. The words I spoke a moment ago, Ahlan wa sahlan, Ramadan, were recently rendered in sand calligraphy on a Gaza beach by a Gazan artist, Feda Ayad, a beach in northern Gaza. He spoke in Arabic and I translate here back into English. I'm quoting his words. Even if we try to cope with the situation, we can't truly feel Ramadan in our hearts. We are trying to cope with all the devastation and loss. We want to feel the spirit of Ramadan, but we can't truly feel it. What I say to you and to the Australian government is that this is what collective punishment looks like. This is what dehumanization sounds like. When people are denied dignity, denied safety, and denied even the space to breathe, daily life becomes a struggle to remain human. And these conditions now exist not only in Gaza, but across the West Bank as well, where Palestinians are terrorized daily. I was last in Palestine in 2019. What I witnessed there echoed what I had seen before in apartheid South Africa. And I will add, as someone who grew up in Queensland, I saw the same on Aboriginal reserves like Palm Island and other reserves further north up along the Cape and into Torres Strait that I know quite well. What we are seeing here are systems of segregation, expansionism, and domination. I also want to briefly explain for anyone who will listen who does not know Arabic a little about the word intifada and the roots of its meaning. I do so in response to recent political efforts, and you know who I'm referring to here, the influence of Gillian Siegel. These recent political efforts to restrict freedom of speech selectively by framing hate speech laws, which are there for only selected parts of our community. The two phrases which are now going to soon go into law in the Queensland Parliament are words which refer to our struggles, particularly this phrase which has gained a lot of attention. Globalizing the intifada. The word intifada, as it's come down to us in English, is through the eyes of the Israeli occupiers. They have experienced two intifadas, and they use the word uprising, perhaps, or they will use the word rebellion. They will have a word which means violent intent. But that is a narrative that Western and English speakers have now more or less adopted when trying to understand the meaning of that word. The original meaning, back to the mists of time, refers to an ability to get something active, engaged, and alive, to shake off as some of you might have heard, to shake off almost like a dusty carpet. You want to put life into the carpet again. Intifada, in fact, actually means resistance. It does not mean violent overthrow. Intifada, and I'm warning all of these legislators across the country, the dangerous laws that you're about to introduce can do nothing but harm to our freedom of speech in this country. Large numbers of people will gather at the southern end of this park for the annual Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras. It's a celebration of the right to live openly and safely in a diverse, creative, and cosmopolitan city. And I'm bloody proud of that legacy. 48 years where a despised minority like mine, once despised, outcast, can have the opportunity to openly and publicly celebrate who we are. Now, that police violence of 78 we have seen again today. And we have also seen, and I have to mention this, over the last several years, an increase in deaths in custody at the hands of New South Wales Police. And I want to mention further the deaths of people in mental distress who, because of a mental health call-out, police arrive and end up either smothering, shooting, or pepper spraying people in mental distress to death. You will not know the statistics and the numbers, but on average, more than 10 people in New South Wales are being killed in this way by New South Wales Police. Back in 1978, and perhaps I can just share this quickly before we move on. One of our slogans in 1978, and I hope I can get you to perhaps join in with me. It's a sad thing that I have to stand here in 2026, and this slogan is still relevant. Let me say this slogan that we used in 78, and if you feel comfortable, you're welcome to join in with me. Stop police attacks.
Stop police attacks.
On gays, women and blacks.
On gays, women and blacks.
Stop police attacks.
Stop police attacks.
On gays, women and blacks.
On gays, women and blacks.
So just to move towards a conclusion, when people gather peacefully to demand justice, when they refuse silence, and when they expose uncomfortable truths, power too often responds, not with dialogue, but with force. What unites us here today is not identity, not background, not even belief. It is a shared commitment to human dignity. It is a refusal to accept that some lives matter less than others. We stand here not because it is comfortable, but we stand here because it is necessary. Silence has never saved a single life. History will not ask what we felt, it will ask what we did when it mattered. I mentioned the city of Sydney for Palestine. It's a group like many other groups around New South Wales, community groups, and I would encourage you to find out which group is in your area. They're all over the state. These are people working together, ordinary Australians coming together, often working at the local government level like the group I'm in has done. I'll just tell you this briefly. In December 2023, the City of Sydney Council, under Clover Law, after a lot of campaigning by us, was one of the first cities in the world to to openly and strongly call for a ceasefire in Gaza. We will continue working at all levels, local, state and federal. And I really do encourage you to join any of the groups that are close to you. I will leave you with a saying quickly from the Sufi tradition, which I learned during my time in Syria. Quote, most people are friendly with those who are outwardly similar to them. The wise are friendly with those who are inwardly similar to them. Thank you, everyone.
Tirano fuori il peggio di me, leggo le accuse nei miei DMs, menti confuse, alludono a cose senza pensare, legge del web. Sono tutti sempre meglio di me, sputano per aria i loro cliché, assetati di attenzioni, sfogano le frustrazioni senza neanche citazioni, olile, olile, filtrano la realtà, sembra che capita, tutti sono verità, che fili tra le mani, robot indottrinati, incatenati ad uno schermo, adattati al contesto di plasma la libertà. Del web.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're on 3CR with Annie and Anila and Tabea on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're going to go to an excerpt from a briefing put together by the Information Rights Project they were talking about the what they called the speech suppression laws, but which the federal government rushed through, calling it hate and extremist bill, combating anti-Semitism, hate and extremist bill 2026. Today we're going to hear a little bit from the lawyer Greg Barnes SC, who gives a bit of an understanding of some of the pitfalls in this hastily put together legislation that's going to affect all of us.
My name is Nevena and I'm the General Manager of the Information Rights Project. Tonight's event focuses on Australia's speech suppression laws, how they operate, how they affect us, and what they mean for our country. We saw these laws justified in the name of national security and social cohesion, but they do raise serious questions about proportionality, transparency, and the long-term impact on freedom of expression. These laws and others like them are something the Information Rights Project stands strongly against. As soon as they were announced, we organised a petition against them, campaigning firmly on the side of freedom of expression and free speech. The bill that was put up was not only un-Australian, but it went against the very idea of justice and fairness that we as a nation hold dearly. Nearly 10,000 supporters like yourselves agreed and signed on to petition. In less than 48 hours, we also organised and wrote to the SNAP Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, which was accepting submissions for only a very short window of time on the Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism Bill 2026. The timetable given afforded Australians and organisations like ours only a number of days to consider and respond to a wide-ranging package that amended criminal, migration, customs and firearms legislation and looked to expand background checking regimes. So we reached out and invited you, our members, to provide written input and to guide our submission. We received more than 1,700 responses in less than 6 hours. Despite the variety amongst our respondents, the submissions displayed a really high degree of consistency with the concerns raised. Numerous submitters expressed alarm that the bill introduced vague and subjective offences, with liability turning on how speech might be perceived rather than if actual harm had occurred. You, our supporters, repeatedly warned us that this approach departed from established principles of law and posed serious risks to freedom of expression and due process. Ours was one of the many thousands of submissions received, but the bill was eventually rushed through our parliament. Shortly after, we set up a petition to repeal the speech suppression laws, and we appreciate and thank everyone who's already signed on to that. To help us delve deeper, we're really pleased to be joined by two people who bring deep experience and perspective on this issue. First, Greg Barnes SC, Information Rights Board member and one of Australia's most respected voices on civil liberties and human rights. With that, I'll hand over to Greg Barnes to share his legal expertise with us now.
Normally, lawyers like to be able to give their clients advice. And normally they like that advice to be as certain as possible within the realms that lawyers can do that and understanding that, you know, police and others can exercise discretion in the way in which they deal with matters. This is legislation where you have to default to a position where you say, I don't know about slogans. I don't know about what constitutes hate speech. I wanted to look up, and this is a typical example, right? You'll see here the definition of religious official and spiritual leader. Now, there is no definition of religion. There is no definition of what it means to be a spiritual leader. And you might think it's self-evident, but we live in a pluralistic society where we have a range of religions, we have a range of other forms of spirituality. What does it include? What does it exclude? Now, who decides? But that's fairly typical of this legislation. If we can go now to page 9, this is the really alarming part. This is the part of the bill that deals with prohibited hate groups. You'll see there that the objects of the bill is to protect the Australian community or part of the community against social, economic, psychological and physical harm. Psychological harm. Psychological harm has a certain meaning if you're talking about personal injuries law or you're talking about victims of crime. We understand it. But what does psychological harm against a group in the community mean? It boggles the mind because it's just so difficult to know. One can understand social harm to some extent, economic harm, if, for example, there are attacks on businesses, and physical harm. One can understand those. But what psychological harm means is anyone's guess. Now, the government can make a group, a prohibited hate group. It has to get advice from the Director General of ASIO. The Minister for the AFP, who's responsible for it, has to then, I think doesn't have to, but should speak to the Leader of the Opposition, and then it goes to the Governor General. But one of the key purposes of prohibited hate groups is that they have alleged to have committed hate crime. And hate crime includes current offences in the Commonwealth criminal law, which deal with threatening violence or incitement against groups or members of groups. A hate crime is also conduct that involves publicly inciting hatred of another person because of the race or national or ethnic origin of the target. Now, you'll notice here, there's no protection here for same-sex community, no protection here for on the basis of other forms of disadvantage, disabilities, etc. So it is purely focused here on race, national or ethnic origin. Bizarrely, a hate crime is not only where you commit a crime under a Commonwealth law. It says if you commit a crime under a state law, if you commit an offence against one of those state laws, that can also be a hate crime for the purposes of the Commonwealth. Yet those state laws are all different. So I might do something in Western Australia, which is lawful. But if I do something in New South Wales, it might be unlawful. So I could be committing a hate crime in New South Wales for the Commonwealth's purposes, but not a hate crime in Western Australia. Hate crime is not designed in a way that makes it easy for people to understand. A hate crime also is conduct which causes serious harm to people, causes serious damage to property, and the motivation is race or national or ethnic origin. Now, that's easier written than it is proved. You might have a person who has a variety of motives. They may not like the person who runs the local bottle shop. They may not like the group that meets at a particular church hall. But that might be personal. That could be a range of reasons. How do you show that that person has engaged in or threatened to engage in because of the person's race or national ethnic origin in those circumstances? Or the target of the property is associated with that person. Now, again, what does targeted property mean? And I'm not going to go into it in detail, but you can see the problem. Does that mean, for example, a synagogue, a mosque? Probably. Does it mean a store, you know, a shop owned by a Muslim person? So it's the imprecision that makes it so difficult to advise people. It says an organisation advocates engaging in conduct constituting a hate crime. This is very important for groups, protest groups. An organisation, by the way, can be part of a larger organisation, formal or informal, which mirrors what's in the terrorism laws. So it can be a group that regularly meets on a Saturday morning to protest against the genocide in Gaza, but it's an informal group. Or it can be a well-organised group that has a constitution, something like the Information Rights Project. Now, you'll see here that advocating hate crimes is if you counsel, promote, encourage, or urges engagement in conduct constituting a hate crime, or you praise the engagement of conduct constituting a hate crime, or conduct that would constitute a hate crime if engaged in Australia, where there's an unacceptable risk that such praise might have the effect of leading a person, regardless of the person's age or mental impairment, to engage in conduct constituting a hate crime. That last part is really difficult, because that means you could have a person with a mental impairment, having acted for many people with mental impairments, they do things for a whole variety of reasons. What does it mean to promote, encourage or urge engagement in conduct constituting a hate crime? If I go to a rally and I say death to the IDF, is that to be taken literally? Obviously not. Some might mean that, but it's against an institution. It's not against an individual. Is that conduct constituting a hate crime? Other slogans are the same. The problem with slogans is this, that they mean many things to many people. And one of the problems with this legislation is that the reasonable person test, in other words, who is it that judges whether or not the particular conduct is offensive, etc.? Normally, it's just a reasonable person, the average Joe. A reasonable person would think that saying that all blacks should be killed is obviously racism, it's inciting, etc. Here, what happens is the reasonable person is the person with the characteristics. So, for example, order of the Netanyahu government, what I think is reasonable might not be what other people think is reasonable, what the community thinks is reasonable. I might be easily offended. So that's another problem, that the reasonable person is actually a reasonable person, but only with the characteristics of the person that is alleged to be upset. Now, the last thing I wanted to say on that, and I'm going to give you an example from South Africa. If anyone's from South Africa here, they'll know what I'm talking about. But this illustrates the problem with trying to legislate in relation to protests and what is said at protests. In South Africa, there is an apartheid song from the apartheid era that says, "Kill the Boer." Taken literally, it would mean kill white farmers and kill any white farmer you see. The higher courts in South Africa have recently ruled that it's got a contested meaning, and that in fact it means it's a protest song. It's not to be taken literally. But what we've done in Australia is that we have said, and we've got governments doing it at the moment, and it's frightening. We've got governments saying that we're banning From the River to the Sea. We're banning Globalize the Intifada. Now, that's essentially saying that these are attacks and inciting attacks, and that there will be attacks on Jewish Australians, which, you know, is palpable nonsense. It's palpable nonsense that these are slogans, again, with contested meaning. You know, what you're getting now as a consequence of the government's legislation and the fear that's being generated is incitement against people who are using those slogans. Look at the pylon of Grace Tang. You know, 25,000 people signing a petition saying she should be stripped of her Australian of the Year. You know, this sort of hatred being generated by the very sort of legislation that politicians are bringing in, they say, to improve social cohesion. Have a look up the top there. The AFP minister is not required to observe any procedural fairness for the purposes of the section. Now, it's a very short provision and it's extreme. It's undemocratic. It's a clear breach of the rule of law. Procedural fairness means that I am entitled to be heard. I'm entitled to be heard because my interests may be adversely affected. And that's why, you know, for example, if the government cancels your visa, generally speaking, they'll give you notice that they're going to cancel it. Under this legislation, you and your organisation could become a prohibited hate group simply on the say-so of ASIO, so you wouldn't know what they were telling the minister. or any other information that the minister seeks to use. You know, that could be after lobbying from particular groups, and you're not entitled to have a say. Sorry, you're now a prohibited hate group. Why? I don't. Well, I'm telling you, because you come within the legislation. Well, can we argue about that? No, I'm sorry. Now, of course, becoming a prohibited hate group has all sorts of consequences for people. The last thing I'd say about the legislation is this, that this legislation is built on the anti-terror legislation. And those of us who oppose the anti-terror legislation said it introduces concepts which ought to be unlawful. Once used here, will be used elsewhere. We've seen that. We saw that with anti-bikey legislation. We're seeing it now with this legislation. So what's next? We're going to use elements of this legislation to prohibit environmental groups. We're going to use it to prohibit organisations that are standing up for whistleblowers. Now, people say, oh, that's extreme. It's not extreme. That's where, you adopt these principles in one form of legislation. You think, that's a great idea. Let's just cut and paste and use it over here. That's what happens. So I'll just say this lastly. The states and territories, or particularly the states, not all of them, but most of them, are now moving to ban particular slogans. You can expect to see that there will be high court challenges. Now, it is likely, in the view of most lawyers, that some of this legislation will get knocked off and some of the state legislation which bans slogans will get knocked off because it's disproportionate. But we do not have a right to freedom of speech in this country, and that's one reason why this organisation exists. You only have what's called an implied freedom to political communication. That's on a case-by-case basis. So you do not have that right to freedom of speech.
You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM, the voice of the community.
A weak solidarity, Bricky Team Listener, when thought we'd introduce Anthropic to the week that was, because I suspect you'll be hearing a lot more of Anthropic, real name, a US of the UN, of the US of a world player in AI, which has upset US Arb Secretary for being offensive and train-killing Pete Hug-Killstuff by refusing to hand over technology to the train killers, forcing poor Pete to invoke wartime measures to force the handover. We don't want AI models that don't allow you to fight wars, Pete explained. Military AI systems must operate without ideological constraints that limit lawful military applications. The Pentagon's AI will not be woke. And it seems Anthropic feels there may be the odd problem with placing warfare and who lives and dies to fully autonomous non-humans, even given the history of humans in that department. Potentially catastrophic dangers, Anthropic warned, as if we can't trust Pete and Big Supremo Donald Trump or the poor in the Pentagon. What could possibly go wrong? To be continued. Meanwhile, the government had more luck here with the big polluters as it emerged that Rio Tinto, the planet, lobbied big economic guru Jim Chalmers' capital to maintain the fuel tax rebate for polluters, a mere $11 billion. The pathways needed for the mining industry to decarbonize are technically immature or are fundamentally constrained by electricity availability, whatever that rubbish meant. And our old mate Woodside with profits demanded that conditions apply to its destroying age-old terra nullius non-land, non-people rock art approval be adulterated to the point where they are meaningless. To which the Minister for Pollution Approval, Murray Swats the Environment, who believe it, concurred. Owen, favoured to be appointed new caring business class party supremo and would-be big supremo Angus Tailing's chief of staff is an oil and gas lobbyist with a long background in the pollution industry, so Mother Earth is in good hands. Big Supremo Anthony Albanese was asked how he felt over the controversy surrounding his comment about former True Blue Aussie of the Year Grace Tame. Difficult, he said. But no, when he said she was difficult, he meant her life had been difficult. We should have realised that, for Anthony, former supporter of the Palestinian non-land, non-people, now a convert to an ardent supporter of the Zion slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation of the non-land, non-people, would have had no objection to Grace's support for the slaughtered. At least he didn't say, she made her bed, she can lie on it, as he humanely pointed out as a matter of state security about the women and children stuck in a Syrian dystopia for whom he has nothing but contempt. But that girl in the middle there is only 12, Anthony, and I have nothing but contempt for her. Made her bed? Her mother and she haven't got a bed. They sleep on that dirt floor. They made the floor, they can sleep on it. But she's a true blue Aussie citizen. Why not bring her home? She chose to be born, and if she was allowed into true blue Aussie, no one would be safe. She's 12. Who wouldn't be safe? Well, me for a start. Angus and the Caring Business Class Party and the Hayseed and Sheepshed Party and Pauline and the No Notion lot would crucify me. These Islamic terrorists have no right to threaten me. But they're women and children, true blue Aussie women and children. Which shows what devious and underhand depths they're prepared to sink to. It's contemptible. And they look so innocent, listener. Shame, shame, shame on all those people, thousands and thousands of cruel, cruel people enjoying schadenfreude over poor Randy Andy. Particularly that photo of Andy leaving the police station over a few matters to do with his very, very, very close former friend, Jeffrey Epsley's. They know sympathy. After all, he used to be a prince and therefore a person demanding our respect and veneration. Worse, the constabulary are also investigating little matters to do with sex crimes, of which Randy Andy assures us he is innocent. Why? Like a growing body of very important filthy rich of the filthy rich suddenly resigning from sundry positions, Andy had no idea his close mate Jeffrey was a sexual predator, pedophile, criminal. Somehow his stint in jail, Jeffrey's that is, Annie's is coming, escaped them all. Even Anthony Albanese has joined the kicker man when he's down stampede, wanting Andy's right of succession to be abandoned, like the seven in front of him are likely to drop dead tomorrow. Come on, a bit of sympathy. Workers are their own worst enemy, aren't they? Proving it by living up to their name. Working. Selfish, selfish workers. And congratulations to the 4.1% of non-workers stretched out in the unemployment queue, doing their bit for the country and the economy, which are the same thing. See, wise economists who understand the greatest little economic order of them all, employed wise economists, know there are not enough unemployed. That all those workers working mean the Reserve Losses Bank will have more than likely to raise interest rates again, hurting those workers, but, well, it's their own fault. There's a simple solution. Stop working. But there are some true socialists who also comprehend the greatest little economic order. Great true socialists like former ACTU secretary and capitalist director Little Billy Kiltthem and former big supremo and the world's greatest worst ex-treasurer Paul. Little Billy, incidentally, says Paul is the founder of the modern true blue Aussie economy. If I were Paul, I'd sue. But then again, Paul seems proud of it. As Little Billy this week gave his solution at a government inquiry into capital gains tax. Adopt the nuclear hawk himself, Paul Little Billy reforms, which brought us neoliberal capitalism, the trickle-down effect, that's those drops of yellow liquid, and laws preventing evil unions from acting like evil unions. Seems 40 years of harsh economic reality has taught Little Billy, and Paul for that matter, nothing. Inflation is down to workers working and government spending. Apparently, the caring business class increasing its prices has nothing to do with it. Like in the surprise, surprise department, when our state socialist government privatised the land titles registry, freeing it from the bloated hand of the public sector, introducing it to the efficiency of the private sector, and what do you know? surprise, surprise, prices have risen dramatically. That's efficiency for you. Macquarie Bank is considering buying out Aware Super's 50% stake for about $4 billion, representing a mere 40% profit on what Aware paid for it. But that has nothing to do with inflation. That's just good business. Displaying our, well, my ignorance of these matters, I suggested if government spending along with workers working is the cause of inflation, then let's abandon Fawkes and save $38 million a day for 30 years and rising. But I was quickly put in my place. That money has nothing to do with inflation or government spending because we're not spending it here other than it's here to start with. As we hand it to the US of and our mother country, His Most Gracious Majesty's home country, Merchants of Death. So it can't be causing inflation here, big economic guru Jim Chalmers Capital patiently explained. Speaking of aware that good business requires making heaps from as few as possible is New York boutique investment bank Centerview Partners' real name, which insists its analysts must work 24-hour days, naturally shocked when one young analyst told it a medical condition required her to have 8 hours sleep a night. And it's not like Centerview didn't do all it could to accommodate her. It allowed her to log off between midnight and 9 a.m. Caring employer allowing a worker to go home at night. Whatever happened to the work ethic? But then it said other workers had to pick up her load after midnight, forcing it to employ a new analyst, uncommon in our lean staffing structure. See, make heaps and heaps with as few as possible. So it sacked the lazy good-for-nothing, who then had the audacity to sue for unfair dismissal. The matter was settled, even though Centerview said it would have prevailed at trial. How dare workers want to go home? Meanwhile, generosity run riot, the Bank of America has decided its workers should only work a 100-hour week after two workers working most reasonable longer hours died. Definitely showing his caring side, Donald trampled the poor, sending a train killer hospital ship to Greenland to treat all the sick people. We're going to send a hospital boat, the greatest hospital boat ever, ever, to Greenland to take care of the many people who are sick and not being taken care of. All the more reason why Donald should own the place. He didn't provide any more detail, unusual for the Don, but we assume they may be sick of Donald insisting on owning the place. Just a minor problem. Donald forgot to check whether the boat, the appropriately named Mercy, was available. It happens to be in dry dock and won't be available for months to treat all those sick people. They just have to wait. Only having to wait just shy of 2 hours, the lucky, lucky audience forced to listen to, or sorry, to enjoy, the State of the Union rambling revelations that the US of has never, never, ever been as utopian, particularly if you're white, filthy rich and love Donald. Indeed, we're winning so much we don't know what to do with it. People are asking me, please, 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 Mr. Supremo, we're winning too much. We can't take any more. Well, we can understand them saying that last bit, but no, the Don could never be accused of hyperbole. There may be just a few minor problems, but they have nothing to do with him. They are fairly and squarely down to the stupid, dumb, dumb, treacherous Democrats, who must have much more influence than we thought they had. Although, in fairness, those polar opposites, one party believing in making the filthy rich richer, the other in making the filthy rich richer, can reach consensus like Eli Ratner, real name, Assistant Secretary for being offensive and train killing with Donald's predecessor Joe Biden Capital, here this week telling us there is consensus in the US of that True Blue Aussie must spend lots and lots and lots more on the US of Merchants of Death. See? Good, healthy bipartisanship. Showing our independence, True Blue Aussie agreed, setting up a $1 billion fund to invest in the Merchants of Death. over and above, as we said, the 38 mil a day for 30 years and growing, we are already handing the US of and His Most Gracious Majesty's home country for the onomatopoeic Focus. Thankfully, all that is in the safe hands of Colonel Balls the Bad Guys. Colonel, I hear you say? Yes. Our Minister for Being Offensive and Train-Killing Richard Maul's the Bad Guys, he of the giant mind, is a colonel. See, back in 2003, when Richard was at the ACTU defending workers, the Kentucky governor made him a colonel. No one has the slightest idea why. As one journalist commented this week, what could a low-level union official from Geelong have done to get it? Consider us intrigued. It also revealed the Colonel's Geelong electoral office is full of US of memorabilia. He's a locked-on US of file, leaving us to ponder what chance, Trubler, was he ever saying no to US of demands for handing more and more of our hard-earned to their merchants of death. As a by-the-by fell upon a Socialist Party promo handout this week telling us they are backing Trubler Aussie workers with a list of achievements, including reducing the gender pay gap to a record low of 11.5%. Some achievement. What about a record low of exactly 0%, given we celebrated the courts declaring equal pay 50 years ago? Finally, a tough little quiz. I won't hang around for your answer because you'll need a fair bit of time to think about it. The original statement was not in the form of a question, but a headline on an opinion piece in the Trubler Aussie Capitalist Review. Okay, pens out, listener. All Benghazi versus tailings could be socialism versus capitalism. Told you it was tough. Little clue. When I raised this on City Limits Wednesday, my co-presenter said, but which is which? Very cynical. Good morning.
Hi, I'm Ahmed from Fitzroy Primary School, and you're listening to Community Radio on 3CR.
Thanks, Ahmed. We're going to finish up the Solidarity Breakfast program today with Giselle Hanna. And, of course, if you stick around long enough, you will hear Giselle Hanna live on Asia Pacific Currents. But this is her wearing the Secretary of the Victorian CPSU hat. She was at the anti-racist forum held at Trades Hall on Wednesday the 25th. It was put on by the Refugee Action Collective, and she, as always, said it all.
Good evening. Mammoth effort from everybody. So well done. I'm Giselle. I too will acknowledge the traditional landowners. This land was never ceded. It was taken by force in an act of genocide, and it must always be central to our organising that we acknowledge First Nations people, their legacy, their wisdom, their spirit. I am the secretary of the CPSU, and I've been in the movement for 25 years, and over the last 2 years in particular, amongst the left, the question is persistently raised, where are the unions? And sometimes that question comes out in lots of different and interesting ways, including how easy was it for the unions to get out, and they didn't. So today I've called my talk, How Easy Is It for Unions to Mobilise Against Racism? And the main answer is it's not very easy. And I want to start from a place of agreement. Racism is real. The far right organising in public is real. And for many people, especially First Nations people and migrant communities and people who are visibly of different races, that threat feels immediate and personal. So I get it. When people ask, where are the unions? The question isn't coming out of nowhere. But I do want to shift how we think about the answer, because there is an assumption sitting underneath that question. And the assumption is that unions are like advocacy organisations, that they can decide on a position, send out a message, and thousands of people will show up. That is not what unions are. Unions are made up of workers, hundreds, thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people. People with different experiences, different levels of engagement, different political views. You don't get to choose who you're in a union with. Racists can and are members of unions. What brings people together in a union is their shared material interests. And as the saying goes, we are stronger together. We need to convince workers that that stronger together transcends race, sex, sexual orientation, religion, and any other weapon used to divide workers. All the things that we heard on the panel today about how systemic oppression actually works. It works on people to behave in ways to other people. That is a reality of the manifestation of systemic oppression. Trotsky argued that the labour movement must defend workers as they are, not as we wish them to be. So transformation happens through participation, not as a precondition. We can't expect workers to come to the movement fully formed with revolutionary politics. That kind of solidarity is learnt and developed in struggle. Lenin was blunt about it. Revolutionary politics does not begin with perfect people. It begins with real people, shaped by real conditions. All of the things that the panel has talked about, what Gabriella Di Vietri spoke about in terms of how the system operates on us. And workers have contradictory beliefs, fears, prejudices and loyalties. If politics required moral consistency before participation, mass movements would never form. Workers are people who are dealing with job insecurity, workload issues, family pressure, and everything that comes with that. So the question isn't, why aren't the unions mobilising? The real question is, how do you organise large groups of ordinary workers to act together on an issue that is political, contested, and often uncomfortable? And the answer is, it's not easy. It takes time. It takes conversations, arguments, and persuasion. It takes trust. And it takes organisation. Because collective action does not happen just because something is important. It happens when people are organised enough and confident enough to act together. And that is the part that often gets missed. Most unions today are not structured for rapid mobilisation. They are structured around representation, around resolving disputes, around bargaining. That work is important because it protects working people, but it does not automatically build the kind of collective power that can bring people into the streets at scale. So yes, unions have work to do, but the work is not just as simple as go mobilise your members. The work is rebuilding the capacity of members to act together. And that means building strong delegate networks. It means having political conversations in the workplace. It means developing leadership across the membership, not just at the top. Because without that, any call to mobilise sits on top of a very thin base. And I think we also need to be clear about something else. Racism is not only something that non-unions or non-unionists experience. It shows up at work too. It shows up in who gets hired, who gets promoted, whose voice is taken seriously, who is labelled difficult in the workplace, in who carries the heaviest load. So I agree, if unions are serious about anti-racism, that's the work that we must do, and that's the work that must happen. And that work is not visible all the time because we're not out on the street. It is slower, it is ongoing, and it requires members to be involved. Which brings me to the most important point. Unions are not separate from the people in this room. We are not an external force that can act independently of our members. They're collective organisations, and our strength depends on how organised the members are. So when we ask, why didn't the unions mobilise, we also need to ask, how organised are the workers right now? How connected are they to each other? How confident are they to take collective action on difficult political questions? Because if that foundation is weak, then mobilisation will be limited. Not because people don't care, but because the organisation to support that action has not yet been built. So yes, we should expect unions to stand against racism, absolutely. But if we want unions to be capable of mass mobilisation, then the task is bigger than calling for action. The task is building the kind of union where that action is possible. Where members are active, where leadership is shared, where solidarity is real and not just words. And this is not quick work. It is necessary work. Because if we want a society that can push back against racism, we need organised workers. And if we want organised workers, we need strong, democratic, member-led unions. That is the work in front of us. Thank you.
Tune in to 3CR's annual International Women's Day broadcast.
On Sunday the 8th of March, we'll be bringing you 24 hours of women's news, views and music.
Talking, a gender analysis of contemporary issues.
Gardening.
Peace and disarmament.
Workplace struggles and the union movement.
Strong women self-advocates with disability.
Environmental justice and direct action.
Why animal advocacy is a feminist issue.
Indigenous women's struggles fighting assimilation and land expropriation.
The modern history of female gender diversity.
Celebrating 21 years of Out of the Pan.
And delving into our archives.
To pay tribute to 3CR's 50 years of radical women's voices on the airwaves.
From midnight Saturday on the 7th of March until midnight Sunday on the 8th of March, we'll bring you 24 hours of radio by women presenters, producers and musicians.
For details, go to 3cr.org.au/IWD2026.
Anarchism 2026 is a public one-day conference hosted by the Anarchist Communist Federation coming up on March 7 at Ballumballum Place. Join us for a day of talks, panels and discussions exploring anarchist ideas, working class history and today's political landscape, as well as real organising lessons from on the ground. Tune in for such great sessions. We're talking fascism and anti-fascism, oppression and class liberation, rank and file interventions in our unions, the struggle for Palestine, BLF, green bans and the climate crisis, and that perennial favourite, Marxism and anarchism. Are they in fact in opposition, or might we argue something else? So if you're interested in a one-day conference on anarchism, check out Anarchism 2026, Saturday the 7th of March at Ballumballum Place in Brunswick. Tickets are available at ancomfed.org, that is ancomfed.org. The Anarchist Communist Federation is a 3CR supporter. 'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist.
And that's it. It's a wrap. And coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. We're going to go out with a Billy Bragg number.
the buses we must pay for. From the cities and the farmlands to trenches full of mud. War has always been the buses' way, sir. Brothers and our sisters in many far off lands, there is power in a union. Now I long for the morning that they realize brutality and unjust wars cannot defeat us. But who'll defend the workers who cannot organize? And the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.